Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Later in the show, I speak with Craig Cox of Environmental Working Group about why, when we've spent so much money on conservation practices, our water quality just keeps getting worse. You might be surprised by his answer. I also visited a town hall forum with Iowa's senior senator, Charles Grassley, this week and have some brief audio clips from that. As chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Grassley is at the eye of a storm brewing about whether or not Republicans will take up President Obama's nomination to the seat vacated by the sudden death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. As it so happens, Senator Joni Ernst is also in the news in ways I'm sure she'd prefer not to be. You'll find out more in a minute. But first, we have a visit from our friendly historian, Alex Pfeiffer, from the Ames Historical Society next door. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hi, Greta. Thanks for having me.
So February is a month when we honor those African Americans who rose above the conditions of racial oppression to make their mark on our society. And one such mark was made upon the football stadium where Iowa State plays its game, Jack Trice Stadium.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we have some great examples of African Americans in Ames history that made a big impact. And Jack Trice is certainly one of those.
So for our monthly Why Is That segment, I ask you, Alex, why is Jack Trice Stadium named Jack Trice Stadium?
All right. Well, Jack Trice, if those of you who aren't into football, maybe new to town, haven't heard of Jack Trice, he was an African-American football player here at Iowa State, actually the first African-American football player. He was born in 1902 to a former slave and Buffalo soldier in Northeast Ohio. When he turned 18, his mother wanted him to move to – I'm sorry, when he turned 16, his mother wanted him to move to Cleveland, where he attended East Technical High School. And he started playing football and track and played football under the direction of Coach Sam Williman. Now, Sam Williman was hired by Iowa State when Jack graduated, and so Sam took all of his best players straight over from East Technical High School and took them over to Iowa State, and Jack was one of those players.
Now, was that school I'm trying to think way back when. So that would be a mixed-race school, or we're not talking about a black school?
No, no, it was mixed-race. In fact, Jack was – they brought one African-American player and then two – I believe they were two brothers over – and brought him over here to Iowa State. And so he was really under – at the time at Iowa State, there was kind of a lull between football seasons. We had just got rid of Pop Warner as a coach, and so we were really looking for someone to step up our program again. And Sam Williman was someone who took East Technical High School, which was apparently a nothing football town, and they really like brought it up to this huge program. So they're really looking for someone to turn around the tides over at Iowa State.
Gee, that sounds familiar.
Looking for one of those guys every once in a while, right? Well, Jack came to Iowa State. He studied animal husbandry, and his plan was to, after he graduated, to head south and help out poor black farmers, teach them modern farming practices to kind of get them up to date.
So that's another story that has a precedent in Ames with George Washington Carver.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of mirroring that, right?
Okay.
Well, now we get a little bit more into Jack's football career. So he had played one preseason game versus Simpson. And then on October 6th, the team was going up to Minnesota to play. And on the second play of the game, Jack broke his collarbone. He decided to keep on playing. And in the third quarter, he was actually trampled by two players and had to be helped off the field.
Oh, my goodness. No, both things are just astonishing. First, that he continued to play with a broken collarbone.
Mm-hmm.
And then that he was trampled.
Yes, he was run over by two players. He was actually blocking for the running back, and they basically fell over on top of him. The running back had to run over his back because there was nowhere to go, so he had to kind of go forward over top of him. And Jack, believe it or not, Jack still wanted to keep playing, even though they had to help him off the field.
Oh, my. What heart.
He's got that determination in him. Well, he was brought to a nearby hospital in Minnesota, and he really did not want to stay up in Minnesota. He wanted to come back with the team. So they put him on on a train car and brought him back to Ames. And they said he was just miserable the entire trip back. You know, think about today. We complain about, you know, we think the roads are a little bit bumpy. But imagine being on a freight car way back then.
Oh, my goodness. With all of that, I hope he had some pain relief medication.
Hopefully a little bit of something. So they brought Jack back, and then they had a doctor from Des Moines come and take a look at him, who's one of the premier internal surgical doctors. And they decided at that point that Jack had lived to this point for 2 days, and it was a little too risky to cut him open and do it, because half the people that went into surgery at that point wouldn't make it out. And so they decided just to wait it out. And
Jack, so it was a matter of delay. The delay caused his condition to worsen or make him more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think so. And it was just, you know, he had some internal bleeding, so it was just kind of slowly working on him there. So on October 8th, Jack passed away, and they had a huge funeral days later on campus where they said the entire university attended, 4,000 people on Central Campus. And when they were getting his body ready for the funeral, that's when they found the famous Jack Trice letter where he wrote on Minnesota hotel stationery, where he's playing not only for himself, his school, but for his race, things like that. And so if you haven't read that letter, it's a very, very compelling letter, and I encourage you to read that.
He's playing for himself and his school, but also his race.
Mm-hmm. So he knew how big of a game that was going to be for him.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So,
and where is that letter?
That letter is actually at Special Collections at Iowa State Library. So they have that preserved, and it's actually also been – they've wrote it out on a plaque, which was in State Gym for many, many years. And that kind of gets more into our question. Why is Jack Trice Stadium named after? Obviously, Jack's story is very compelling, but how did it happen? Sometimes that's more of a question, not why, but how. Mm. And so Jack died in the 20s, and, you know, looking into the future, we go through a depression, a world war, and Jack is a little bit forgotten on campus. His story is, you know, enough time has passed. There's been enough tragedy in America that he's been forgotten. And they did have a plaque for him up in State Gym, and with some remodeling and stuff, it kind of became hidden in a corner. And flash forward to the 50s, and we have a student here, Tom Emerson, who still lives here in town, and many people know him. He was at State Gym one day and happened to notice the plaque there. And so he went and talked to the physical ed department there. And he went on to tell him the story about Jack. And so Tom Emerson went through and grabbed all the research he could and wrote a nice article on Jack and kind of brought him into the spotlight again. And then he, you know, kind of gets forgotten for a little while. And then the 70s, they bring it back, and there's just this really large student movement to get the stadium named after. Now, 1973, Clyde Williams Field, which, if you're not familiar with that, is would have been at the corner of Lincoln Way and Sheldon near Friley Hall, just south of State Gym. And that was getting an antiquated football field, so they were building the Cyclone Stadium, the stadium down what we know today as Jack Trice. They were building that, and there was a big push from the students to get it to be named Jack Trice Field. Unfortunately, it didn't quite take hold, and they named it the Cyclone Stadium. But in 1984, they were able to get a compromise, and they were able to keep it Cyclone Stadium, but then named the field after Jack Trice.
Oh.
So for a little while, it was still Cyclone Stadium, Jack Trice Field. And then it wasn't until 1997 that they officially got the stadium renamed in his honor. While they were doing another remodel, they decided to do that. So
incremental change.
Yes, yes. But it's amazing how the students kept that going for, you know, 50-some years, still trying to, you know, not quite letting go of it.
They kept the ball, carried the ball.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is just amazing when you look, you know, people are here 4 years and
right,
can turn out. So to be able to keep passing that torch along is just great. I think it's really amazing. There's been some people that have done some great research on Jack Trice, too. I want to point out Joshua Kavagi, and I'm sorry if I pronounce your name wrong, Joshua, but he lives out in California, and he's a big Iowa State fan, and he's done a lot of research on Jack Trice, where they actually figured out his jersey number. For many years, we had no idea what his jersey was, and he found a program over at Simpson for that first preseason game that Jack played, and they had him listed as number 37. He's also been in contact with other football collectors and got this great, an actual action shot of Jack playing football. And so we have so few shots of him. Mostly are just of the preseason photos where they're all standing together in their nice, clean uniforms. So it's really amazing. And this kind of ties in. If you don't know anything about Jack Trice or like to learn more, we're having on Tuesday night, February 23rd at 7 p.m., we're going to play Real Connections. We're going to show a movie called I Will, The Jack Trice Story, which is a brand new documentary done by Cyclone TV and with B&G Productions. And it's just a really – it's an hour-long film, and it's just so fascinating. I thought I knew the Jack Trice story, but there's so many other little layers to this, little facts about him that just make it so compelling. And if you are interested in that, I would highly recommend coming to see that.
Okay, so Real Connections on Tuesday, February 23rd.
Yep.
Where is this, Real Connections?
It's at the Ames Public Library. And that'll be at 7 p.m. And this is also co-sponsored by the Ames Public Library, too.
And as well as your organization.
As well as the Ames Historical Society, yes. And it's just such a wonderful film. These guys have popped in every once in a while trying to get some photos and do things. And it really did turn out great. I highly recommend it.
So that's at 7?
7 p.m., yep, February 23rd. So on Tuesday night.
Okay, well, that should be great for the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Alex Pfeiffer.
Yeah, thank you, Greta, for having me.
Yep. And that was our regular segment, Why Is That? And if there's anything around Ames that you wonder why it is, so ask us. Send us a question and we'll forward it to Alex and maybe you'll hear more about it later on. Well, last Saturday, the world learned that Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, had been found dead in his room at a luxury hunting ranch. Scalia was known for his conservative decisions, most notably the Citizens United decision, which opened the floodgates to corporate cash in elections, and Bush versus Gore, which awarded George W. Bush the presidency after controversies about hanging chads and other irregularities in Florida left the nation in a quandary. So according to the Constitution, it is the president's job to appoint a replacement justice, quote, with advice and consent of the Senate. Within 2 hours of the announcement, Republican presidential candidates such as Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Marco Rubio were promising to throw a wrench in the works and delay confirmation hearings for Obama's nomination until his term ran out. The battle cry, as you will hear, has been to, quote, let the people speak for who they want in the November presidential vote. Democrats and others protest that they have spoken when they voted for Obama. Meanwhile, Obama has yet to announce his choice for the nomination. At the center of this controversy stands Iowa's senior senator, Charles Grassley, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and hence the first gatekeeper of the advice and consent process. Senator Grassley just happened to have on his calendar this week several town hall meetings, where his format is always to field questions from the audience for an hour. I attended the senator's visit to Tama City Hall on Tuesday. The very first question was about the Senate confirmation hearing. Well, actually, it wasn't. The first question was about Michelle Obama's alleged profligate spending and how many paid staffers she has. Oh, well, this is a false rumor started in 2009 that seems to be enjoying a revival these days. The second question, then, appeared to be coming out of the other corner.
Okay, next question.
Since you're the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, are you going to get another Supreme Court justice appointed within 30 days? People are out here getting sick and tired of what the Republicans and the Democrats fighting back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, we're the taxpayers. We're paying you guys. So I think that should be done as soon as possible.
Okay. Well, I've made a very clear statement, and I don't know whether it'll hold. It'll hold as far as I'm concerned until I'm overruled that we should put it off till after the election, and that's not based upon a Republican point of view, because 2007, 18 months before Bush was going out, the guy who's going to be the next Democratic leader in the House or in the Senate said that if there's a vacancy in these last 18 months, we aren't going to have this president appointed. We're going to wait till after the election. And he spoke about balance on the Supreme Court, we kind of figured the same way that he thought then. So it's kind of a bipartisan rationale that when you get close to an election, the people ought to have something to say. Now, you want it done in 30 days.
It's in the Constitution.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Well, there's no time on that.
Okay. Yes, there is.
No, there isn't.
Hey, you're both right. He's right. It's in the Constitution. You're right that there's no time on it. So, listen, the president can make the appointment.
Right.
Okay. And then if you read the Constitution, it says with the advice and consent of the Senate. So the Senate can do its job two ways. It can consent or not consent. And because of an election year and because of the balance of the court, we feel that the people ought to have a say in it. And so not about an individual. Forget the individual. It's kind of an opportunity for the people to have a say. It's the people here in Tama.
Later in the meeting, Sue Dinsdale, an advocate for Iowa Citizens Action Network, who we had on Local Talk recently, asked for a little clarification from Senator Grassley. She had read in an article that Grassley would not, quote, rule out initiating the confirmation process. Grassley quibbled about the content of the headline versus the content of the article and told her, read the article. Well, Sue pressed on, asking, what is it then? What are you saying?
We're going.
What do you plan to do? Will you take a vote? Will you do the hearings? Will you?
I just said, you don't. We're going to do everything step by step, see? And what's the next step? The next step won't come until the president makes an appointment. Next question. Go ahead.
The issue came up again at the end of the town hall meeting when a woman asserted how dangerous the world is today, mentioned, quote, this Antonin Scalia thing that just happened, thanked Senator Grassley for all his decades of service, and asked what she could do for him.
If you could write to congressmen letters to the editor saying that you are a lady here in Tama County and you'd like to have some say and who might be the next person on the Supreme Court. And then you got to listen to the debate between the two candidates and then decide which one is more in your tune and pin them down on are they going to put a strict constructionist on the Supreme Court. See, that's what you can do. But you need to, people need to get this discussion going. And even if it would turn out different than I want it to in the November election, I think it would still do a great deal of good to let the people in Tama, Iowa, feel like they're a part of the process.
Of course, Senator Grassley's term in the Senate ends in January 2017. He presumably will be one of those candidates of which he speaks and signals that he thinks this issue might work for him in his 2016 campaign. We shall see. When I asked Senator Grassley whether the people hadn't already spoken by electing Obama twice, he went back to invoking Charles Schumer and the bipartisan rationale on obstructionism. But then, a moment later, I heard him repeat the phrase step-by-step approach when talking with the reporter from Waterloo Courier. So, Local Talk listeners, I just report, you decide. I found out afterward that Iowa's junior senator, Joni Ernst, will be conducting a similar town hall meeting in Tama today, Friday. If I were to make a return visit to Tama, I would ask Joni about Trees of Liberty. After this break, we'll have more information on what Trees of Liberty is.
Alone yard by a light in the sky in a Cincinnati wonder. Friend of mine told me once of his second sight. Get to perfect with wonder he might. Slow these dreams and get me to turn. Sail away, sail away, to a land that matches my view. Get away, let us meet in the sinister view. All the signs of the tropical tree and the girl waits in my room. So convincing, can it be real?
And that was Obsidian's Dream, my new favorite local band. They played last night at the Pantorium for our Third Thursday event that happens every month and just really rocked the place. And it was a beautiful night, beautiful people, lots of smiles, and even some kids dancing around. You couldn't beat that vibe. So kudos to our team that put that event together. And I look forward to next month's Third Thursday on March 17th. Well, I mentioned Trees of Liberty. Trees of Liberty is the name of a 501c4 nonprofit organization that the Koch brothers poured $400,000 into to get Joni Ernst elected as U.S. Senator. As you may have heard, these nonprofits have flourished since the Citizens United case of 2010, which allowed corporations to give unlimited amounts of money to these 501c4s. They are nonprofits, and so they can engage in some campaign activity, but the majority of their work, more than 50%, must be in the public interest. And for most conservative 501c4s, that means educating the public about the importance of liberty or the Constitution or something like that. But late in January, the Center for Media and Democracy of Madison, Wisconsin, filed a complaint to the IRS and Department of Justice against Trees of Liberty. And so the details of this complaint are essentially that the nonprofit did not report its political activity in 2014. And then furthermore, that 50% split, you know, you must have at least 51% of educational, good for our society kind of stuff going on to qualify as a nonprofit, and the rest can be campaign activities. Well, not so much. They pretty much spent 95% of what they had on Joni's campaign. And this was definitely Koch money coming from a kind of a slush fund that the Koch brothers set up called Freedom Partners. So basically, they've filed a complaint with the IRS saying that this organization that funded Joni should not be a nonprofit. Of course, those who fund it get tax breaks because they're giving to a quote-unquote charity. This measure, however, is complicated a little bit by the fact that Trees of Liberty is no longer in existence. This is the nature of these dark money organizations, that they come and go, and they can break the law and then disappear, and no one can really do anything. So the Center for Media and Democracy, I talked to them yesterday and asked them, well, who is going to be, what are the consequences for this complaint if the entity no longer exists? And Brendan Fisher, who I spoke with, said, they're doing it pretty much as a test case, kind of testing the system that we have now, which is obviously pretty leaky. I wish we could have spoken with Brendan, but that's what we have. Okay, we are going to move on to an interview that I had with Craig Cox of the Environmental Working Group on what's happening to the Iowa landscape. This is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. And last week, a report entitled Fooling Ourselves was released by the Environmental Working Group. This report documents changes in the use of two important conservation practices in eight important watersheds across Iowa. Given the efforts that have been made in recent years to clean up our waters through better conservation practices and the publicity these efforts have enjoyed, what the Environmental Working Group found is rather shocking. Now, Environmental Working Group is a national organization focused on the environmental consequences of various parts of modern life on people's health. EWG has its headquarters in D.C., but because it does a lot of work on agriculture, it has its Midwest office here in Ames. So I asked the Midwest director, Craig Cox, to come over to the studio the other day. He brought his assistant, Soren Rundquist, who did much of the work on the study. Here, Craig Cox describes the basic study question of their research.
The big question that's being asked is, you know, traditionally we've relied on this so-called voluntary approach, where we have money available, cost-share dollars available for landowners, and they volunteer to change their farming practices or land use in one way or another, and the taxpayer shares part of the cost. We've been doing that since, you know, the 1930s. And the question is it working? Is it going to work? Can we rely on that approach to clean up Iowa's waterways? And, you know, in the last, since 2005, just in the federal USDA programs, we've spent $3 billion in Iowa. So why aren't we seeing more improvement? Why isn't water quality better, even though we've had that, you know, really substantial investment? And what we had seen in just driving around Iowa in the Midwest is it seemed like these conservation practices blinked on and off, that a practice would be applied, but that didn't mean it was going to stay, that it could disappear. And we decided to take a harder look at that, a more quantitative look at that, by focusing on eight watersheds that had been selected as priorities for the nutrient reduction strategy and use aerial imagery to track what happened to two particular conservation practices. And I'll let Soren pick it up from there.
Okay, Soren Rundquist.
Yeah, so as Craig stated, we deployed aerial photography to monitor the existence of two practices, grass waterways and buffers along streams and rivers. And in these eight watersheds, it was rather interesting when in the course of 4 years between 2011 to 2014, we saw for buffers a decrease in net acres and a meager gain in total miles of grass waterways installed. If you look specifically at the numbers, we found within that 4 years, there were numerous instances where producers had installed riparian buffers, 45 acres went in. However, in that same time period, there were around 119 acres taken out. Approximately, you know, 74 acres were lost in net if you factor in what went in and what came out. So while some producers took steps to put buffers in, more buffers were taking out, leaving a net loss of 74 acres within 75 feet of the shoreline. And then for grass waterways, we saw an increase where producers installed 26 miles of grass waterways directly on cultivated fields to filter and slow down water coming off those fields. And at the same time, there were 21 miles of grass waterways taken out, leaving a positive gain of 5 miles. But, you know, within 3 years and billions of dollars spent, you know, 5 miles is relatively little change. So those findings really, really enforced what we were seeing driving around the landscape, that while many producers are voluntarily putting in these practices, many are voluntarily taking them off the landscape, thus essentially leaving taxpayers to absorb all the cost of implementation and really seeing no progress in terms of lasting conservation on the landscape.
A few questions come to mind. First of all, just so our audience knows what we're talking about, grass waterways would be kind of installing a strip of grass where you might otherwise just have a gully in a farm field because that's the way the water tends to flow?
That's correct, yeah. So using high-resolution data inputs, specifically a product called LIDAR, which measures it's a laser that's shot at the Earth's surface, and the time calculated to bounce that laser back to the sensor calculates the actual, you know, within centimeters, the elevation of the surface. So using those data, EWG was able to model how water flows off the landscape and thus target, you know, those specific instances where grass waterways would be
beneficial.
Beneficial, exactly.
Yeah.
And also quantitatively assess, does a grass waterway exist, you know, in an area that's highly susceptible to
right.
runoff directly on the field.
And that would be great data for other organizations to have, too. Like,
of course,
you know,
yeah.
the Soil and Water Conservation District.
Yeah,
and
yeah. And it's freely available. It's, you know, largely produced and maintained by state and federal governments. And, yeah, you have to have a little know-how in terms of how to ingest and use the data. But, you know, there's a plethora of good information in there that can be deployed to do studies just like this.
So this is satellite data, not plane flying data.
The LIDAR would be a plane.
Oh.
It's a radar, more or less, shooting a signal at the Earth. And then the data we use to validate whether a vegetative practice, being a buffer or a grass waterway, existed were aerial photography. So that was flown by a plane too. Satellites are very useful if you're doing larger scale studies because they can cover a lot more ground. However, your resolution is more coarse and you lose a lot more precision, especially if you're monitoring a small space of 75 feet. You're not going to be able to do an assessment that accurate with most satellites.
Okay. So we got straight into the wonky part.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I can go on and
that's
on
okay.
and put people to sleep.
But this data, just to clarify, is already available, or
yes,
you guys
yes.
had to
and
hire these
no,
pilots?
No, no, and these data are also a freely available resource maintained and provided by the U.S. Department of Agriculture called the acronym is NAIP, N-A-I-P, the National Agricultural Imagery Program. And they, in most states in the Corn Belt, they will fly 1 meter resolution photography for the entire state, usually annually.
Hmm.
So it's a great resource, and it's a great resource to track progress because you have a nice catalog of high resolution photography to monitor. You know, are these practices disappearing every year, every other year? Are they staying for 10 years? And
that's very interesting. So. I guess the big question is why? Why do we see farmers putting in and taking out? I'm sure corn prices have to have something major to do with that. Is there any other reason that, in terms of policy, that farmers are taking land out when they know that water quality is important to Iowans and that there's a major push to improve the water quality through conservation measures?
Well, I can tell you what farmers have told me. That I've asked landowners and farmers what they think is happening. And I get three answers almost all the time. One is that so much of the land is not owned by the person who's farming. Like in Iowa, over half of the cropland is leased to the farmer, not owned by the farmer. So a lot of time the farmer, the person actually farming the land, doesn't have as much to say about what happens on the land they're farming that you'd think they would have. So I've heard lots of stories from farmers about, you know, disagreement on what the best way to farm that land that they're leasing. And, of course, most of this land is now rented, you know, cash rent on an annual basis. And frankly, you know, farmers have told me that some of those landowners are way more interested in the cash. In fact, that's about all they're interested in is in the cash. So in some cases, conservation-minded farmers are put in a bind by, you know, whatever the attitudes of the landowner are. The second thing I've been told is that this was especially true during the big price boom, is that farmers were expanding the number of acres they were farming. So remember, there's a pretty narrow window in which you can plant.
In terms of time.
In terms of time. So if they were going to be able to farm successfully these larger acres, they had to have bigger equipment. And the bigger equipment needs bigger fields, right? So they saw a lot of fields being expanded mm-hmm. in size. And, of course, if you're using big equipment, it both slows you down and is harder to drive around these conservation practices. So they've told me that they saw a lot of these practices go out as these field sizes were expanded and operations were bigger and had to get their work done faster, and maintaining these practices is inconvenient, gets in the way. And then the third thing they, the farmers I talked to almost always mentioned was Roundup, that you really have to slow down unless you have some really state-of-the-art equipment to make sure your spray doesn't drift over onto the grass strips that are planted along the stream bank, or, you know, especially the ones that are planted in the middle of the field, the grass waterways. So those are the three reasons that farmers themselves have suggested to me that they think was driving the changes we see on the landscape.
Wow. And those are all related to other trends that have come into farming, the increase of the use of land as an investment, further distancing of the landowner from the activity of farming,
that's right.
The tenant-farmer system that has been on the rise. And then you mentioned the price boom. But with the price boom, people are expanding operations, changing the financing of their system.
That's right.
Putting big money into big machines, expecting that in return. And then the Roundup, which has just come to dominate the agricultural practices since the introduction of Roundup Ready corn, after the introduction of Roundup Ready soybeans in the last decade or so, just overtaking all other forms of farming.
I think that's right. And I think, I think the world has really changed in farm country. And I think our public policy is not keeping up. And we're thinking that the way we used to try to get conservation on the ground 30 years ago is still going to work in today's farming world. And I think, the Fooling Ourselves report that we just released is just one little indication that, business as usual is just not going to get the job done anymore.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and we are listening to my interview with Craig Cox, Midwest Director of Environmental Working Group, about a new study the organization released called Fooling Ourselves, Voluntary Programs Fail to Clean Up Dirty Water, which has demonstrated that despite the emphasis on water quality and nutrient reduction in Iowa, more conservation acres are being taken out of the 8 Iowa watersheds they studied then are being put in. So I asked Craig Cox about how federal conservation funding levels were affecting the process. I recalled that in the 1990s, the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, was a big deal. This had been instituted in the 1985 Farm Bill, and by this practice, taxpayers essentially rented farmers' land to install 10-year conservation practices on them. I knew, actually, from visiting the town hall in Tama on Tuesday that conservation dollars had been cut in the 2014 Farm Bill, as, in fact, they had been cut in previous Farm Bills. That certainly affected the results. And, in fact, the researchers at EWG found that 80% of the riparian buffers they saw taken out had formerly been CRP lands. Iowa once had 2.3 million acres of CRP. It now has 1.6 million acres. But more important than the CRP program, said Cox, was another federal program, also instituted in the 1985 Farm Bill, known as Conservation Cross Compliance. And this program requires proper management of vulnerable land, either marshlands or highly erodible land if the farmers want to be eligible for federal crop subsidies. Other farmers who don't have vulnerable land are automatically eligible for these subsidies. But if you are a landowner, a farmer who happens to farm land that is highly erodible, then you would, in order to get the subsidies for your crops, you would have to visit your NRCS office and get a plan and execute the plan, do everything the plan says, that the conservationist says must be done to help that land stay in place. So that particular program, and Craig Cox called it a quid pro quo. In other words, you have to do this conservation every year in order for you to get this subsidy every year. And this one affects 11.5 million acres in Iowa compared to the 1 or 2 million in CRP. So, in fact, in the 2014 Farm Bill, this quid pro quo requirement was actually expanded to taxpayer subsidies for crop insurance, which is absolutely essential for farmers to operate. Taxpayers currently pay two-thirds of farmers' insurance payments. And so this was considered a win for conservation. The problem is, says Cox, the enforcement is poor.
In the conservation compliance world, there had to be significant enforcement. You know, USDA actually had to go out and inspect. But enforcement has become very lax. You know, a lot of farmers have told me it's a joke now. I mean, no one pays attention.
So Cox is hopeful that this relatively new aerial photography and aerial data that enabled his study will also allow NRCS agents to pay closer attention to what farmers are doing. And, of course, there's climate change. Cox mentioned that the rains come hard. They come often in the spring or even early winter, as we saw this year, when the fields are bare and most vulnerable. All of these factors contribute to his thesis that the practice of farming has changed and policy has not kept up. So I asked Craig Cox of EWG what kind of change they were advocating for.
What we are advocating for is what we call a basic standard of care, that there should be a set of conventional, fairly simple conservation measures that we think landowners should be expected to have in place, whether or not there's taxpayer assistance to apply and maintain those practices. So we don't want every farmer to have a EPA permit or a Iowa DNR permit, but we think there's some activities that are really disproportionately damaging, and we think landowners ought to be responsible to heal or to end those practices. So the big four that we've thrown out to get the conversation started is you ought to have at least 50 feet of grass or other permanent vegetation between cropland and waterways in order to filter the runoff that's coming off your cropland in entering waterways. The ephemeral gullies that you talked about, they ought to be healed. There ought to be a grass strip on those gullies, or there's other measures that can be taken to interrupt that flow. We think you should at least be managing to some extent the access of livestock to streams. You know, those hooves as the livestock goes in and out of the stream can really beat up those stream banks. And we know that erosion from streams and stream banks is a huge source of phosphorus and sediment in Iowa and across the Midwest. We're not saying you have to exclude the cattle completely, but, you know, at least harden the bank where they're going in and out of the water. And finally, you know, applying manure on frozen or snow-covered ground is just, it's not a good practice. And, you know, in the springtime when it's snowmelt or we get heavy spring rains before the ground is, you know, while the ground is still frozen, it's just a disaster. So So those four things won't solve every problem in Iowa. It won't get us all the way to the goals in the nutrient reduction strategy, but it would really make a big difference. And then we could use the increasingly scarce dollars for voluntary programs. You know, they could come into play on top of that basic standard of care and help people go way beyond that, you know, meeting those basic requirements. So that's what we think would finally get us closer to really lasting, enduring progress cleaning up Iowa's water.
Well, I like the language, basic standard of care. I mean, we expect that for children, for instance. You know, parents have to do a certain amount of care, and so it should be for our land.
If you look around the states, there's pieces of this basic standard of care already in place in a number of states. Even in Iowa, there's already regulations about when and how manure can be applied to frozen and snow-covered ground. So it's not as far-fetched as I think sometimes it gets portrayed. And you know, I think a lot of farmers, if they were tasked with coming up with their list of what ought to be expected of landowners, based on my conversations, I think a lot of them would come up with a similar list because, you know, they know it's some of the, I mean, planting your corn in the stream, that's not good business. You know, gullies all over your fields, that's not good business. And it's not good for agriculture's brand either. So I think if you pulled farmers together county by county and asked them to come up with a basic standard of care, I think they'd come up with a good standard.
Maybe if you separated the farmers from their advocacy groups, you'd have a better chance of success.
Yeah.
Anything else that we haven't touched on yet about this report, Fooling Ourselves, on the conservation practices, 2011-2014?
I would briefly add that we're not starting from zero. You know, in some cases, you know, we did a study last year titled Low-Hanging Fruit where we actually monitored the buffer existence, you know, in five counties throughout Iowa. And some counties had more than 75% of riparian buffer in existence. So, you know, we're not starting from scratch on this. And, you know, in most cases, you know, farmers already have these. You know, we're trying to single out the bad actors that, you know, could use a little more conservation on the landscape.
It's part of the mystery that we've seen, even in the aerial imagery that Soren has been analyzing, is, you know, one farmer will just be doing a fabulous job of conservation on that piece of ground. And then, you know, across the fence, it's a completely different story, right? So why? Why can this one landowner or farmer be doing all of this stuff to clean up Iowa's water and the neighbor isn't? Why? And I think that's part of what is mysterious to us. That shows that, you know, you can do these practices, you can stay in business, you can thrive, and yet some folks are on board and a lot of folks aren't.
Yeah. And with the basic standard of care, this would also completely erase the first problem that you mentioned, which is that landowners may not be farming the land themselves and may put restrictions in the place of farmers who, you know, might prefer to do things the right way. If they're required, there's no discussion.
That's exactly right. And I think this big change in who's farming the land versus who owns the land is a major reason why we need a basic standard of care. It's because we need some responsibility put on those landowners, you know, not just the farmers. And until those landowners do have some responsibility, I think we're still going to be struggling to, you know, to do what needs to be done.
Well, thank you very much, Craig Cox of Environmental Working Group. He's the Midwest Director and Senior VP. And Soren Rundquist, researcher for the group. Did you go to Iowa State?
I'm a Hawkeye, fortunately.
Oh. Oh, them fighting words. Okay. Well,
everything you said is no longer believed by anybody.
No credibility.
Did you grow up among farmers?
I did. I grew up in Northwest Iowa in Sioux City. So, yeah, I know. My great-great-grandpa, farmed in eastern Nebraska, and, growing up, all my friends, most of them came from farms. So we're asking for, a healthy balance for the environment, and we're asking for a lot of practical things that most people could get behind, whether you're farming the land or driving by.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
Again, that was Craig Cox and Soren Rundquist of Environmental Working Group. They have their office right there on Duff Avenue and 6th. We're going to go out with another song by Obsidian's Dream, the Boone area band who played in our studio last night as part of our Third Thursday event. If you happen to miss that show, I'm sorry, but you can get on board the Groove Train yet and go to the March 17th Third Thursday event. This is just a rather melancholy song about loss, and I found it just beautiful. So, listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Our guests were Alex Pfeiffer from the Ames Historical Society talking about Jack Trice. Then we heard some audio from Senator Grassley and Tama. And finally, I spoke with Craig Cox and Soren Rundquist of the Environmental Working Group about conservation practices in Iowa. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's shows. You can also like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, who makes all that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Thanks also to Jonah DeGeest for his commitment to this morning's broadcast. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And, of course, you are listening to Obsidian's Dream. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and see you again on the radio. From free to stay.